This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
In Afghanistan, people tuning into TV news are seeing the Taliban's new reality. Fully covered female anchors.
The only thing that you can see is really their eyes.
Also today, England's central bank has a message for financial institutions there. Ignore climate change at your peril.
Early action is going to save you a lot of money. Very little action is going to cost you a lot more. No action, there's going to be a lot of financial problems.
I'm Marco Werman, and the enduring fascination in Europe with Middle Eastern art, an ornate headpiece by the Paris jeweler Cartier, is a great example.
It looks like this colonnade of arches, and we were able to trace back this connection with a mosque in Cairo.
Plus, Londoners are seriously jazzed about their new rail line and Taco Tuesday with a tight twist. The stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us. Today marks 3 months since Russia invaded Ukraine with shelling of the capital Kyiv and other cities. Since February 24th, most of the fighting has shifted to eastern Ukraine, to the regions of Donbas and Kharkiv. The Kremlin's earlier ambitions have narrowed, and it's now focused on Ukrainian areas that border Russia. The Wall Street Journal's chief foreign affairs correspondent, Yaroslav Trofimov, has been covering the war since it began and joins us now. You recently embedded, Yaroslav, with a Ukrainian military reconnaissance team in the Kharkiv region in eastern Ukraine. What did you see?
Well, this is a team that is really on the border of the Kharkiv region and Donetsk regions. So that unit, its mission is to stop the Russian thrust south, the Russian attempt to encircle the bulk of the Donbas region. And they've been successful. So the Russian offensive started mid-May, and the unit is still there. It's been bombed day and night. They're operating out of a basement of a building in a village that gets shelled almost constantly. But these people go out on missions. They are hunting Russian tanks and Russian armor. And they're using various means at their disposal. You know, they have drones that can drop munitions. They have Javelin anti-tank missiles. They have Stugna missiles that the Ukrainians make. And they can also operate by calling strikes by Ukrainian artillery, including American-supplied howitzers that are tens of miles away sometimes, and by the Bayraktar drones. So they keep fanning out into the countryside, spotting the targets. And then once the targets are spotted, they have to take care of them themselves or call in help from other units in the Ukrainian military.
So you're seeing American and Western weapon shipments and aid actually on the front lines and contributing to Ukraine's successes?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So the weapons that were shipped earlier on in the war, such as the Javelins or the NLAW British anti-tank missiles, you see them throughout the front lines. And they have really played a crucial role throughout this war. Now, we have also seen more sophisticated weapons, particularly the howitzers that the U.S. has supplied. We have seen them towed to the front lines around Donbas and being used in this fight now, yes. And the Ukrainian soldiers say that they are very important because of the precision guided munitions that they can use. So basically what they do, they would fly a drone, they would spot a target, and then they would call in a strike with the howitzers that would destroy the target.
So taking a step back, Yaroslav, how has the state of the war changed since February 24th? What is most kind of remarkable?
When the war began, the military campaign that Russia had launched at the time was to destroy the Ukrainian state and overthrow the government in Kyiv. So that quick push failed. And so by the end of March, the Russians withdrew from northern Ukraine. They withdrew from Kyiv, Chernihiv, Sumy, and focused the campaign on seizing Donbas. So that push also stalled and basically failed. So now in this third phase of the campaign, the Russians are advancing in a much narrower strip of Donbas. And if they are successful, then they will attempt again a bigger push. So everyone in Kyiv is geared up for a very long war. And they say that even though the tactics have changed, the strategic goals of President Putin haven't.
So today marks 3 months since Russia invaded Ukraine, and most experts say the war shows no sign of ending. If you look back at your own reporting from the past 3 months, is there something that you've learned or surprised you that might suggest where the war goes next?
Well, you know, Ukraine has shown its resilience. Life in Kyiv is almost normal now.
Almost normal, you say?
Yes, if you return to Kyiv from, you know, the war zone Donbass, restaurants are open, you know, there's traffic in the streets. Probably 2/3 of the people who had left early in the war have returned. You can get, you know, fresh sashimi in the restaurants in Kyiv. So clearly the sashimi supply chain hasn't been disrupted.
I guess that is normal.
Exactly. So you can say the same for, you know, pretty large part of Ukraine. You see that the war has become much more localized in the Donbass area, whereas in the rest of the country, life is almost normal because the only threat that exists there for now is the Russian cruise missiles. The Ukrainian air defense systems are able to keep the Russian warplanes at bay. There has been almost no attempts by the actual Russian planes to come into the Ukrainian airspace outside the immediate front lines. So Russia fires 20, 30, maybe 50 cruise missiles at various targets in Ukraine every day. Some of them get shot down. Most of them hit the targets. Sometimes they miss. But again, you know, in Kyiv, the last time a cruise missile hit a target was weeks ago. So it's been weeks without any casualties inflicted by the Russians in the Ukrainian capital.
Yaroslav Trofimov is the Wall Street Journal's chief foreign affairs correspondent, speaking with us about the war in Ukraine 3 months to the day since Russia's invasion. Yaroslav, thank you.
Great to be on the show. Thank you.
British banks could lose big on climate change. That's a conclusion that came today from the Bank of England, the UK's central bank. More specifically, British banks and insurers could incur losses up to 15% annually if they don't respond to climate risks. John Morris is assistant professor in economic geography at the University of Nottingham. He joins us from Birmingham in the UK. To start with, John, these conclusions came from a stress test for banks that the Bank of England, the equivalent more or less of the US Federal Reserve, they conducted. So what types of climate risks are banks and insurers facing?
Generally, when you do this stress test, you're interested in two types of risk. One would be a physical risk, which is, say, a climate event or a weather event, the kind of thing, say, that a tornado or hurricane might wipe out a lot of real estate. And then the other kind of risk is a transition risk. And that's the kind of risk where, say, if a new government policy or tax came in, say, a tax on, say, fossil fuel emissions or something like that, if you suddenly introduce a policy like that, that's probably going to incur, say, losses in financial markets. So you'd be interested to know what kind of policies and kind of mitigation strategies might cause disruptive losses in finance.
So how should banks and insurers respond to these latest findings? How do you prepare for future losses due to climate change?
What's come out of these tests is that you've got three scenarios. One is that there's an assumption that there will be a lot of early action to mitigate climate change and to transition towards a low emissions economy. There's a second scenario that's saying there'd be kind of late action towards this. And a third scenario, which is really deliberately a very bleak scenario, where there's no action at all. And I guess what these three scenarios are doing is saying to the whole sector, here's the cost of acting early, here's the cost of acting very late, and here's the cost of not doing anything. And I think the big message that the Bank of England is saying to insurers, reinsurers, and banks is early action is going to save you a lot of money. Very little action, it's going to cost you a lot more. No action, there's going to be a lot of financial problems.
So when the stress tests tell banks you need to take action, what actually should they do? I mean, are we talking about mitigating the losses, or should banks become activist institutions when it comes to climate change?
This is a really great question. And it's a great question because it feeds into the nature of what these types of tests are. And I don't think there's necessarily something in that mandates that banks take action. But it's very much this idea that in a market, if you give people better information and perhaps start to steer banks towards the idea that the cost of fossil fuel investment and the cost of carbon is going to get higher, that they might start to take action to protect their business models and to make sure that they ensure profits and to make sure that they are fulfilling their objectives to their boards and shareholders. The Bank of England does have the ability to recommend action, which is something that has particular legal and regulatory weight, but I don't think they've necessarily said they're going to be doing that. So I think this is very much still the bank trying to use a learning exercise to encourage the financial sector and to very much try and mobilize the idea of self-interest in order to prevent financial stability problems, but presumably also save the planet.
I mean, an exercise, but by conducting these stress tests, what does that tell us about the concerns at the Bank of England as they look into the next 10 years? And what message do the results send to the UK government?
First of all, it says that certainly since 2014, 2015, the Bank of England became very much concerned about the threat to financial stability, particularly, say, insurance from physical risk, but also those transition risks. And this has been a part that they and other central banks have really formed on a consensus on this, that central banks have some kind of role to play. There's still a huge amount of politics about what that role is, as you're now seeing in the United States with the Federal Reserve and various appointments to the Federal Reserve being held up through political processes. But I think it's very much saying that something does need to give, that even though there's an uncertain future, there does need to be some kind of action. And I think it's one that is fundamentally underpinned by the idea that the financial system has been mispricing the risk associated with carbon and fossil fuels. And it's an attempt to send out a signal that the cost of investing in carbon is certainly in the longer term going to be a lot.
John Morris is assistant professor in economic geography at the University of Nottingham. He's been speaking with us from Birmingham in the UK. John, thanks very much for explaining this.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
In some parts of Indonesia, keeping caged songbirds is an old tradition. You'll find this especially on the island of Java. And now, raising birds with the best songs and whistles, that's turned into a competitive sport.
Hundreds of songbird contests take place across Indonesia every year.
That's Charlie McCann, Southeast Asia correspondent for The Economist.
You'll see these referees walking, under these caged birds, judging the complexity and range of their melodies, also taking note of their stamina and posture as they kind of dance around their cages. For Indonesians, watching these songbird contests is much like watching a football or basketball game.
Birds with the winning songs can bring home cash prizes, motorcycles, even cars. The owners of the champion birds, McCann says, care for them as if they're their own children.
Keeping songbirds has been part of the culture on Java, Indonesia's most populous island, for a very long time, centuries. A bird in a cage is actually one of the symbols of Javanese knighthood. Contests, though, didn't start to take off until the 1980s and 1990s, and that's because that was when contestants started replacing imported zebra doves with native songbirds. And the reason that's important is because these zebra doves, their vocalizations are fixed. They basically can't be trained, unlike these songbirds. So with this shift, it really opened up the tournaments to anyone who had the time and the patience to coach their birds.
But Charlie McCann says the growing popularity of these contests is not good for the songbirds. The demand for birds means that dealers are hunting for them in the wild.
So many birds have been taken from the wild that more than a dozen species are in danger of going extinct. So traders are now looking further afield to the forests of Malaysia and Thailand too.
McCann says there are some things being done to prevent these birds from becoming extinct.
I spoke to Serene Chung of TRAFFIC, which is a wildlife monitoring group, and she says that the Indonesian government is aware of the problem and does forbid trade in protected species. And 4 years ago, it updated its list of protected species, which was important because it hadn't done that in 20 years. And it added hundreds of birds, including songbirds, to that list. And she also pointed out, very frequently we see news reports about the authorities confiscating birds that have been smuggled illegally and basically rescuing tens of thousands of songbirds.
That has reduced the trade somewhat.
The authorities are confiscating ever more songbirds, and yet you have estimates, like one researcher thinks that as many as 1 million birds were smuggled out of the forest of Sumatra, which is another big Indonesian island, in 2019 alone. And that's because, even though the government is thinking about this issue and it has updated its list of protected species, there are legal loopholes. Traders exploit those loopholes, and they exploit the fact that many of these laws are patchily enforced. This is the tragedy of this sport. Indonesia's love of birdsong threatens the songbirds themselves.
That was Charlie McCann, Southeast Asia correspondent for The Economist. She shared her story about the popularity of songbird contests in Indonesia on the podcast The Intelligence. If you look at the designs of the iconic Parisian jeweler Cartier, you may not immediately think Islamic art, but it's time to look again. Our story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. When you think of great Islamic art, Texas may not be the first place that comes to mind, but right now at the Dallas Museum of Art, there's a new exhibit that brings together about 400 pieces from the iconic jewelry designers at Cartier, the French luxury brand. The Cartier family drew artistic inspiration from a lot of places, including Islamic culture. The World's Shirin Jafari has our story.
The name Cartier has been synonymous with opulence and luxury, going back nearly two centuries. British King Edward VII described Cartier as jeweler of kings and king of jewelers. The family business started in Paris in 1847 by Louis-François Cartier and later his son, Alfred, and grandsons, Louis, Jacques, and Pierre, took over. They expanded the company and found inspiration from the art and designs of places like Russia, India, and the Middle East.
The moment is important. It is here that history begins.
This is a promotional video made by Cartier.
1903, Louis Cartier pays a visit to the Musée des Arts Décoratifs in Paris to discover a first-of-its-kind exhibition dedicated to the Islamic arts.
There were a series of major exhibitions that were happening in Europe at the beginning of the 20th century.
Sarah Schleining is the curator of the exhibition at the Dallas Museum of Art. She says these exhibitions sparked Louis Cartier's fascination with Islamic art.
And across things like the Ballet Russe and Scheherazade, the performance of 1001 Nights being done, introduced in 1910. So there becomes this big zeitgeist synergistic sort of moment of interest, and that really spurs this as a sort of source of a modern expression.
Louis Cartier collected pieces from these exhibitions, things like Persian miniature, cigar boxes with geometric designs, and photos of Islamic architecture. And slowly, we start to see those designs incorporated into Cartier's pieces. Schleining describes one of them. It's a 1922 bandeau, a band that women wore around the head, made of coral and onyx.
It looks like this colonnade of arches, and we were able to trace back this connection with a mosque in Cairo and these photographs there were in the Cartier archives. It was something that was exhibited at the 1903 exhibition of Islamic art at the Musée des Arts Décoratifs.
She says Cartier clients would often use their own gemstones and ask Cartier to design around them. But the company also sourced its own material from different parts of the world. Jacques Cartier visited the Gulf country of Bahrain, where pearl diving was popular. And he wrote to his brother about finding the most effective way to buy pearls from the markets there. Schleining says, we know a lot about how Cartier pieces came together because the family documented everything.
These books and portfolios and resources were available to the designers, as was the fact that the works of art that Louis privately collected, he photographed.
The exhibition at the Dallas Museum features sketches for necklaces, brooches, and tiaras. They incorporate geometric shapes and lines. The Persian motif botte, or what's become known in the West as paisley, is used in a diamond and turquoise tiara. I asked Sarah Schleining about this exhibition, France's colonial past, and the current debate surrounding the return of objects from European and American museums to their original homes. She says part of the project at the Dallas Museum of Art is to connect Cartier's designs with the sources that inspired them. The bandeau is just one example.
And to say, hey, this wasn't just a phenomenal colonnade of arches, but this came probably from this mosque in Cairo. And here we can trace that. And so now we're broadening that understanding.
The exhibition is a collaboration between the Dallas Museum of Art, the Musée des Arts Décoratifs in Paris, and Maison Cartier. It runs until September 18th. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
We've got photos of the jewelry Shirin described, along with video links for the exhibit at the Dallas Museum of Art. That's all on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. In Afghanistan, the Taliban recently ordered all women to wear head-to-toe clothing in public. Only their eyes may remain visible. The rule also applies to female television anchors. In the newsroom at Tolo, Afghanistan's most popular broadcaster, the announcement was met with anguish. Before she went on air, Tolo presenter Yalda Ali posted a video as she put on a covering to hide her face. Her caption read, "A woman being erased on orders from the Virtue and Vice Ministry." Many female news presenters defied the ban on day one. Tolo presenter Thamina Usmani began covering her face on Sunday, a day after the Taliban's new rule went into effect. She was not happy about covering up.
This decision not only makes me angry, but wearing the mask, I can communicate well with my audience. They may not know my face in the future. It is a very difficult for us. This is an unjustified comment.
For more about how Afghanistan's press is dealing with the Taliban's edict, we reached out to Holwak Sapai. He's the deputy director of Tolo News and spoke with us from Kabul. He said Tolo had to obey. The Taliban did not allow the network any option.
They told us very clearly that we have to obey, and we were told that there isn't any room for discussion.
I should point out that we were hoping to speak with a female anchor in Kabul, but unfortunately, many women presenters comfortable in English have fled the country. How did the men at Tolo News respond to this edict?
They're wearing masks as well, like a moral support and just a gesture of unity, the gesture of sympathy with our female journalists, female presenters.
Yeah, so the photo I saw of the male presenters, they were wearing face masks for COVID. Yeah. So that was in solidarity with the female presenters, is that right?
Yes, it's exactly. It's for the solidarity with our female journalists.
So Holwak, I'm wondering if you've given any consideration about what to do if the Taliban decides that women's voices on air are haram, forbidden in their interpretation of Islamic law. How will your male staff respond to that?
That is a big question. As the director of the channel, now I do not know what's happening tomorrow, what will happen tomorrow.
Lots of unknowns. We also reached out to Mahbuba Siraj for her reaction to the new restrictions on women TV news anchors in Afghanistan. Siraj is a women's rights activist in Kabul. She says by requiring female TV anchors to reveal only their eyes, something important is being taken away from them.
The women in Afghanistan are being used in such a unbelievable ways. It's becoming like a nightmare. Because every single time they are turning around and they're coming up with something new to limit the freedom, the access in life for the women of Afghanistan. And I don't understand why there is such a deep, deep dislike by the Taliban. But it is happening, and I cannot deny it because I see it every single day. The only thing that I can ask the world to do at this point is really pray for us, because I don't know how far and how long and for what reason this is all happening.
That's Mahbuba Siraj, a women's rights activist in Kabul, reacting to the Taliban order requiring female TV news anchors in Afghanistan, all women, to wear full face coverings. You're listening to The World. During a pandemic, a hospital is a busy place and a loud one.
I thought, wow, there are so many different beeps here. They were mostly very high-pitched, very harsh, loud.
For years, people have been trying to tame the machines that go bing. Then COVID gave them new energy. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Thousands of photographs of incarcerated Uyghurs in China's Xinjiang province, details of re-education camps, and a shoot-to-kill policy for people who try to escape. Some details from a trove of hacked police files telling the stories of an oppressed minority in northwest China. The files were leaked to a researcher and then shared with a consortium of media. Darren Byler has read the report. He's a specialist on China's treatment of Uyghurs at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. I mean, these are literally police photos of Uyghurs who have been detained in Xinjiang, Darren. How do they further the story of what we know about the persecution of Uyghurs already?
Well, I suppose that the greatest impact from these images is that they're images, that it's visual documentation of things that we've seen written in internal police documents already, and they're so gripping. They put the viewer in the position of the police officer taking that image. And you see tears welling up in people's eyes. You see how they're treated as criminals. And there's something really eerie in all of these images of faces because the eyes are all aligned in the same position, which is an indication that it's used as part of a face recognition surveillance system. So it's just a sort of devastating just to look at the images. And then there's these other details about shoot to kill, those that try to escape. Another detail about 2 million people estimated from a local official that are infected with extremism, which is the euphemism used for those that should be detained. So it's, you know, just really driving home the point that this is real, this is happening.
Do these photos, these mugshots basically, do they also confirm numbers or data you and other scholars already had?
Yeah, that's right. So the 2 million number that the local official says is the number of those that have extremism in their minds. That confirms the estimates that we had before of 900 to 1.8 million people that were detained. It's actually a bit higher than what we had seen before. And it also confirms that people are being detained for really innocuous thought crimes, for things that aren't crimes at all, for being related to someone who's been going to the mosque too often or read the Quran on their own.
I mean, details like these have leaked out over the past few years. I'm just wondering, what is the main narrative that these pictures now alter?
What they're showing is the criminalization of average citizens, of regular Muslims, regular Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and Hui people that are from this region, 15 million people in total. It is showing us that 10 to 20% of the adult population have been criminalized and have been detained. They are from the earliest stages of detention, so the processing intake moments. But we know also from the other documents that are included in this and in other documents that this process is ongoing, that many of these people, hundreds of thousands of them, are still missing. Some are now in factories, some are actually in formal prisons, and others are still awaiting their trial. They're in detention centers, which we see documented in these images.
Does the 2 million figure refer to the number of Uyghurs in detention currently?
It's hard to know exactly. That was this local official's estimate. So it's hard to know exactly if they are still all in detention, but it's giving us a classified document, a statement from an official saying that this is what they think the target should be.
So let's drill down that 2 million number down to just one person. Can you give us an example of one of the photos and what we know about the person who's depicted?
One of the most gripping images is of this woman who has tears in her eyes. And, you know, she has just been criminalized. And our understanding is that she's being detained because she's a relative of someone, her son, who was detained previous to this because of his religious beliefs. So she's really guilty by association. Another couple images show the children of a couple who are also being documented, likely to be sent on to a state-run residential school, which is typical for lots of children in this region now.
What do we know about who might have leaked these photos and documents?
Well, it's really important actually to protect the personal details of the person who's released these documents because their safety is a concern, which means that they're a Chinese national. It could be that they are working within the police force or within the party system, civil servant of some sort who has classified access. It could also be, though, that they're a contractor, someone who's working with one of the technology firms who's charged with collecting this data and housing it and making it accessible for, you know, artificial intelligence analysis. It's one of the first internment camp systems that's using artificial intelligence as part of the diagnostics and also control of populations in internment.
Do you know, Darren, anyone, or do you recognize anyone in the photos?
I don't recognize anyone in this photo set of people that I know, but yes, dozens of people I know from the region when I lived there in 2014 and 15 were later detained. And I know this from going back in 2018 and going to their neighborhoods, talking to the neighbors and them confirming that these people had been taken. So I have many personal friends that are in camps that are quite similar to the ones that are documented in these images.
So this latest report coincides with a visit to Xinjiang of UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet. There's some ambiguity about the purpose of her visit. Do we know what kind of access she'll have to Uyghurs, actual Uyghurs?
It's not entirely clear. I know that she and her team are quite aware of the situation on the ground. You know, they've spoken to many of us prior to their visit. So I think they're doing their due diligence by actually going to visit. But I think they're quite aware of how the visit will be planned and how access will be actually quite tightly controlled. There's also a lot of changes that have happened since the first waves of mass internment. And so they're, I'm sure, going to see factories where people are working and appear to be kind of within a normal factory complex, at least during this visit.
How surprised were you when you saw this new evidence and the details?
Well, it confirms a lot of what I've seen in internal police documents and other evidence over the years. But it's always just shocking to see it presented visually in high resolution, you staring directly into the face, into the eyes of someone whose life has been completely shattered just moments before and is now disappearing. For me, it recalls images I've seen, you know, in Cambodia or, you know, in the Holocaust. Of course, these people are likely still alive, the people we see in these images, but it's a similar dynamic of a systematic targeting of an ethnic group.
Darren Byler is a specialist on China's treatment of Uyghurs. He's at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. Darren, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
For decades, many people and countries around the world have looked to the United States as a global leader on abortion rights. But with Roe v. Wade expected to be overturned this year, that might be changing. We've been reporting on reproductive health rights around the globe. Mexico seems to be going in the opposite direction of the U.S., as we hear now from the world's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
The abortion laws in Mexico are a patchwork connected by lots of gray areas. One case that illustrates this happened 3 years ago.
Fue un escándalo.
Dalia de la Cerda is a women's health advocate in the central Mexican state of Aguascalientes. And she says this case was a scandal.
Era una, en ese momento tendría como unos 15 años. Era una adolescente.
At the center was a 15-year-old girl who had been sexually assaulted, de la Cerda says. The girl had become pregnant and her mother took her to a public hospital for an abortion. But she was denied any medical intervention.
O sea, el juez lo llevamos ante los juzgados federales. Y el
De la Cerda says she helped take the girl's case to court. A federal Mexican law had been approved just 3 years earlier, guaranteeing access to an abortion to anyone who'd become pregnant after sexual assault. And according to multiple media reports, the judge ordered the hospital in the state of Aguascalientes to give the girl the procedure.
Y la respuesta a un juez federal fue, me estás pidiendo lo imposible. Porque el juez les dijo, no te estoy
and the hospital's response to the judge, as De La Cerda recalls it, was that it was impossible because their medical staff morally objected to abortion. In the end, De La Cerda's collective, Morras Help Morras, helped the girl and her mother travel to the relatively liberal Mexico City for the procedure.
A nivel nacional ha cambiado mucho de leyes. Pero al mismo tiempo que nosotras avanzamos,
Mexican abortion laws have dramatically liberalized in recent years. But at the same time, De La Cerda says, those laws are often not enforced. Just last September, Mexico's Supreme Court ruled that pregnant people can no longer be sent to jail for having an abortion. Activists like De La Cerda celebrated the ruling, even though the consequences are not fully clear.
First of all, Mexico is a very Catholic, very conservative in some ways country in terms of sexual and reproductive rights.
Rebecca Ramos is with GIRE, an independent health advocacy group in Mexico City. While Mexico has been slowly relaxing abortion restrictions over the last two decades, it is still not legal in three quarters of Mexican states.
I think that there is a gray area. The Supreme Resolution, it is not so clear on that terms. Of course, we can challenge a prosecution, accusation against a doctor, but it's not so clear in comparison with what happened with the women or the people who seeked the abortion.
One medical service that has come into higher demand is online health assistance. For example, there's Telefem, an independent organization that began providing services last year from Mexico City to people anywhere in the country. Paula Rita Rivera Núñez is the director.
Soy matrona de profesión, a midwife.
Rivera Núñez says they give counseling and medical assistance to people who wish to safely terminate their pregnancies at home, or they help them find in-person services.
Que si no hubiese nacido del fragor popular, todo esto tal vez...
Rivera Núñez says women's movements across Latin America are responsible for a lot of the change. They call it Marea Verde, or Green Wave. Since 2018, organized groups of women waving green bandanas have been marching in cities across the region, and they've successfully pushed for abortion rights in Argentina, Colombia, and Mexico. And right now, they're all looking at Latin America's northern neighbor.
Sí, estamos muy pendientes de lo que pueda suceder.
Fernanda Díaz de León handles public policy for IPASCAM, a women's health NGO in Mexico City. She says that since Roe v. Wade was passed 50 years ago, the United States had been an example on abortion rights.
Pues estamos frente a la posibilidad de que Estados Unidos se encuentre en un...
Now, Díaz de León says if Roe gets overturned, abortion rights in the U.S. could suddenly be where Mexico was 20 years ago. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
The London Underground is infamous for being crowded and hot. There's a brand new London rail line, though, the Elizabeth Line, named after the Queen herself. It opened this morning. But will it live up to the hype? From London, the world's Orla Barry reports.
Mind the gap between the train and the platform.
Braving the tube during rush hour in London is not for the faint-hearted. And in the summer, temperatures on some trains can rise to nearly 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Not on the new Elizabeth line, though. The carriages are cool and air-conditioned, and this morning hundreds of train enthusiasts lined up for hours to try it out.
Hello, Castle Town, and welcome to the very first Elizabeth line service today.
Among them was Jeff Marshall. I ask him how excited he is on a scale of 1 to 10.
Is it possible to have more than 10? 14?
I'm worried I might be too excited, yeah.
Marshall knows pretty much everything you'd ever want to know about London's new rail line. He runs a popular YouTube channel all about transport in the British capital. He was invited to test out the Elizabeth line a full 3 months before it officially opened.
You walk into the stations and it's a complete contrast to what the Victorians built. So in the 1870s, 1890s, they built all these fiddly little stations, which we're still dealing with today with their twisty corridors and their tight corners and their inaccessibility. And here, they've come in, they've gone, let's make everything twice as big, twice as wide, twice as long. And so it's the scale when you walk in. People will be like, whoa, whoa.
London has the oldest underground transport system in the world and plans to build the Elizabeth line actually go back decades. Here's Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, talking to Sky News this morning.
The first plans for this particular line were talked about in the 1940s. When I was a transport minister in 2009, the first construction began in Canary Wharf. It's a landmark moment for our city.
Mayor Khan predicts that the new line will increase London's rail capacity by 10%. A journey from the centre of the city out to Heathrow Airport will soon be a cool 40-minute ride instead of an hour and a half slog in a sweltering tube car. This new train line is the largest infrastructure project undertaken in Britain in decades. Tony Travers is an urban affairs expert at the London School of Economics.
It is of epic standards, partly because London is such a large city. But beyond that, like the station's a cathedral-like in their scale, very beautifully designed with uplighting. So it's not just that it's a piece of mega engineering of the kind you might expect to see in a rapidly developing country like China, but it's also very beautifully designed.
But it's had its issues. The Elizabeth line was scheduled to open in 2018 and budgeted at around $17 billion. So far, it's cost about $24 billion, and it's not finished yet. The final stage of the line is expected to be completed later this year. Tony Travers says he thinks it'll all be worth it in the long run.
As with all major rail projects, it's hard to say it's worth it now, though, you know, I think 20 or 30 years from now, people will wonder how they ever lived without this new Crossrail line.
Transport officials say the new line should also see lots of Londoners leaving their cars at home. John Whiteleg has worked on sustainable transport projects in several countries, including China, Germany and India, and he's sceptical.
The idea that building this railway line will stop people use or reduce car use is absolute nonsense and not supported by evidence. And if we want people to reduce cars, it's dead easy. And you reduce the space for cars by two-thirds. You allocate one-third for pedestrians and cyclists, one-third for buses and one-third for traffic.
And Whiteleg, who lives in Shropshire in the Midwest of England, brings up another question.
Why can we find it possible to find £18 billion in London when there's hardly anything like that in Liverpool, Manchester, Newcastle, Leeds and so on?
Back at Canary Wharf Station in London, I put that objection to train enthusiast Jeff Marshall.
You know, London is the capital city, 9 million people, heart of the financial district. There is a knock-on effect. If London is doing well, then that, I always feel, filters down to the rest of the country.
The Elizabeth line already has a nickname. It's known as the Purple Train because the new line is colour-coded purple on the London Tube map and all of the signage is in that colour. 30 iconic London landmarks, including Tower Bridge, were lit up in purple last night to mark the opening. And today, Jeff Marshall is wearing a purple T-shirt with the words Purple Train written across the front. He tells me that he and some of his mates have come up with a new song to celebrate the Elizabeth line, inspired by the one and only Prince.
And it's like, I never wanted you to miss your destination, I only wanted you to stay within the zone. And then the chorus is, I only want to see you riding on the purple train. Purple train, purple train. I only want to see you riding on the purple train.
For the world, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Necessity, as they say, is the mother of invention, and tacos, in the estimation of our newsroom, are a necessity of life. So let's take a moment to honor the engineering students at Johns Hopkins University, who this month presented their capstone design projects. Among them, Taco Tape. Actually, that's our name. They named it Tasty Tape. It is a safe-to-eat, clear adhesive tape that keeps your taco closed up, neat and tidy, when you bite in. Because, you know, physics. Tasty Tape works on burritos and gyros as well. Johns Hopkins says the students research the science of adhesives and tensile strength while making sure all the ingredients of the tape are edible. The innovation was developed by students Tyler Guarino, Marie Eric, Rachel Nye, and Aaron Walsh. We and our shirts no longer stained by sauce salute you. As much as hospitals have a reputation for being quiet, they actually create a lot of noise, especially during the pandemic. With ICUs at or near capacity, think about all the alarms beeping off the hook. According to one study, hospital COVID wards have been among the loudest. This crosses cultures. The beeps are a universal annoyance, so people across the globe have been reimagining sounds for a more soothing hospital wing. The world's Bianca Hillier reports.
About 10 years ago, Yoko Sen found herself in an emergency room. She tried to focus on her health and resting. But the cacophony of sounds swirling around her made that next to impossible.
I thought, wow, there are so many different beeps here. They were mostly very high-pitched, very harsh, loud, on top of, you know, people talking, screaming, doors are getting slammed. Very, very chaotic environment.
As an electronic musician, one particular confluence of alarms stood out to her.
There is a sound of one medical device, and oh, it's a note of C. And oh, that's Bedford alarm, it's a high-pitched F sharp. And they're beeping together.
This combination of notes is considered so disturbing that it's called the devil's interval, and it was banned from medieval churches.
And that's what we hearing in hospitals over and over.
Sen couldn't fathom how nurses and doctors dealt with these sounds day in and day out. So once she recovered and left the hospital, she started asking them how they managed.
They say, I hear these alarms in my dreams when I get home. One of the physicians said, I don't have any electric appliance at home that makes beep because I'm so tired of hearing those machines.
The soundscape of hospitals isn't just annoying. It can be harmful. Studies show that ICUs reach decibel levels double what the WHO recommends. Machines for a single patient emit hundreds of beeps per day, and many of those are actually false alarms. It leads to a widespread phenomenon called alarm fatigue.
It's the cry wolf phenomenon.
Judy Edworthy is a professor of applied psychology at the University of Plymouth in the UK.
If you signal that something's happened and it hasn't happened, then the more you do that, the less inclined the person will be to believe that that thing has happened.
Edworthy says nurses end up either ignoring alarms or wasting time coming into rooms to turn off the false alarms. Another issue is that the current machine noises all sound the same.
They all go da-da-da, da-da in different ways.
Listen for yourself. Here's the sound that monitors ventilation, artificial perfusion, and drug delivery. They're hard to tell apart, and to the untrained ear, they don't mean anything. They were also never tested. One of the scientists key in approving these alarms, Dr. Frank Block Jr., has even publicly apologized for their inadequacy. Now, Judy Edworthy has the solution. She spent the past few years redesigning the old sounds you just heard. For example, she's turned the ventilation alarm from this into this. And the drug delivery alarm now sounds like this. Yes, that's a pill bottle rattling to a recognizable rhythm. Edworthy says in experiments with hospital staff, these sounds were easier to understand because they're literal and they sound really different from one another.
You're not going to mix those sounds up if they go off simultaneously.
The global governing body, called the International Electrotechnical Commission, agrees. Though not yet mandatory, Edworthy's new sounds are now the recommended audio for medical devices around the world. Still, designers are continuing to push the boundaries on how hospitals could sound. A team in the Netherlands came up with this track to represent heart rate, oxygen saturation, and blood pressure. When a patient's heart rate goes up, the first sound in the melody also goes up. And when the heart rate exceeds a safe range, it sounds out of tune. Researchers say this example is in response to hospital staff wanting musical updates as a happy medium between traditional alarms and actual music. Yoko Sen is also experimenting at her company, Sen Sound. She finds inspiration in organization pro Marie Kondo, who is from Sen's native Japan.
She helps you evaluate every single item you have. Does it spark joy? And it would be beautiful if we could take every single sound that we hear in a given unit and evaluate one by one. They don't have to spark joy necessarily, but do we really need this one?
Sen adds that silence isn't her goal. One of her most profound projects looks at what sounds can be added to a hospital when a patient is passing away. She traveled the world asking people what they'd like to hear as their last sound.
A lot of people like sound of ocean. It's very calming. Many people want to hear the voice of their children or laughter of babies or the mother who already passed on. They're all sounds of life in many ways, sounds that really symbolize what it means to be a human.
As COVID-19 continues to keep ICUs busy around the world, Sen hopes the pandemic can shine a spotlight on this overlooked area of healthcare and lead to a sound environment that's more healing for all. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Uruguay's Jorge Drexler knows something about medicine and sound. He had been a doctor, an ear, nose, and throat specialist. Then he became a musician. That was about 30 years ago. Valiente o gallina, la bolsa o la vida, picar medicina, chupar golosina, perder la partida, beber tu saliva, jugarme la vida, buscarme la ruina, tocarte, tocarte. The song Tocarte, Touch You, is the first single on Jorge Drexler's new album, the first one he's recorded in 5 years, written and produced during the pandemic. Not surprisingly, he reflects on love and loneliness. The first songs Drexler wrote in this time focused on the fear, the masks, and the distance between people. By the time he wrote this song, Tocarte, it was as if he was swearing off loneliness and ready for human contact again. Quiero que el barrio entero sepa de nuestra obsesión y presumir de ti besándonos en el balcón. Idolatrarte hasta que te hartes y entrar contigo en brazos en la suite del Sheraton. Drexler sings he wants to kiss his lover on the balcony of their room at the Sheraton. Lonely no more, I guess. New music there from Uruguay's Jorge Drexler. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow. La bolsa o la vida.